All right, tougher bluff, Birdo. Focusing on your entitlement will boost your creativity. So if you want to boost your creative juices, you got to focus on your own entitlement, what you deserve. What do you think? Is that tough or bluff?
I'm going to go bluff. I've heard that if you focus, if you think about a time where you were successful, that can boost your creativity. But this one feels actually backwards, because if I focus on my entitlement, I might be too complacent for me to get creative.
Interesting. That's my, would that happen to you?
My wacky hypothesis.
Would that happen to you? If you focused on your entitlement, would that reduce your creativity? Do you need to feel undeserving?
Wait. No. Maybe I'm wrong about this. Deserving. All right. I don't know. It's a tough question, but I'm still going to stick to my bluff.
It's tough. The scientists stimulated entitlement in half of the study participants through a short exercise in which the participants were encouraged to write sentences about why they deserved various positive outcomes. Participants then took part in creativity tasks, including imagining different uses for a paperclip, drawing a space alien, and participating in a word association exercise. Findings showed that participants who were given a boost in feelings of entitlement outdid the non-entitled on every test. So if you want to be a little bit more creative, then you should focus on things that you deserve.
I have a right to be more creative, damn it.
Yeah, which is interesting. It's
fascinating.
It is interesting. A lot of studies come out showing that when we are positive about ourselves, when we acknowledge what we deserve, when we pump ourselves up, you know, and people do this all the time when they're about to go on stage, like an 8 Mile, and Rabbit is looking into the mirror and he's like, I got this, you got this, you're, you know, or in Pulp Fiction when, or no, Reservoir Dogs, or was it Reservoir Dogs.
Pulp Fiction, where Travolta's in the bathroom and he's like, all right, you can do this, whatever.
Oh, okay.
But
it's also in Reservoir Dogs when Mr. Orange is undercover cop and he's like talking to himself in the mirror. He's like, you're a badass.
Yeah, yeah.
you're super cool. You're super cool. And so I think we should all be looking at ourselves in the mirror and saying rad things about ourselves.
And the sense of entitlement aspect of it means that you actually have to like believe that what you do will be successful, right? Because you're like, I deserve success, right? So,
right.
Man, that must mean I'm one entitled feeling mofo, because I'm usually fairly creative.
Yeah, I think it makes total sense. When you feel like you're going to get it done and you deserve it, and you feel confident that you're definitely going to succeed, I would say that would absolutely grease the wheels. All right. Well, let me grease your wheels with the fact that this is called the Psychology in Seattle podcast, and I am your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist, a licensed therapist, and I'm also a professor.
My name is Humberto Castañeda, and I am a political psychologist.
Right. What's your real job, Berta? Come on.
My real job is I'm a motivation and power coach.
You're a motivation and power coach.
Yeah.
So you deal in like power outlets and electricity?
Yep. Well, mostly on the motivation for people to use them.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of people are lazy. They don't want to plug their phone in. They don't want to plug their laptop.
Yeah. So let's role play. I need some coaching on that.
Okay. Listen, man, I know you're scared, but it's just three little holes. You just got to grab this thing and just slam it in.
But I'd rather have it work without me having to put effort into it.
That's a great idea. Do you feel entitled to that? Maybe we can invent a way for it to be wireless.
Plus, don't you realize that we're ruining our planet by using
electricity? This is why I can't get enough like work these days, because I keep getting convinced out of my job.
Man. You're easily anti-convinced. All right, tougher bluff. Checking your email less frequency will reduce your stress. Tougher bluff.
Tough.
Wow.
Tough.
Why?
Oh, I can speak from experience, dude. I get all these emails about like, I can't plug in my laptop, my outlet's scary. And I get it. And I'm always checking emails at all times. And it is stressful. Whenever I go away for a weekend and I put my phone away.
It's tough. When participants only check their email 3 times a day, which is still 3 times a day, they found that participants felt less stressed.
I do wonder something about that, though. What if you check only 3 times a day, you know, and it's like you come later and you see an email message that says, where the hell have you been? I've been emailing you for hours.
Yeah. But it's pretty rare that that's the case.
It is pretty rare.
And I have to say, I can absolutely, because the thing is how many times do you get a very traumatic email? Probably like one in every 100 times something. Some email where it's like, we've got to have a meeting to talk about how you screwed up in this situation. You've been uncoaching people from their power a lot. And so for every time that that happens, your stress level goes up regarding all emails. So now when you just get a junk mail, you have this visceral reaction like,
that's true.
Is this going to be bad? Is it going to be good? You know,
it's like opening bomb presents all
right.
the time.
Right.
Is it going to blow up or is it good? Is it going to blow up?
Right.
Is it good?
Right. Because, and I bet you anything, if they did like, well, how about opening Facebook messages? Because Facebook
right.
messages are always friendly and nice.
No, but people post news also. And
no, not on Facebook itself, but Facebook messaging.
Got it,
do you have that Facebook messaging app?
No, but I know what you're talking about.
When I send you Facebook messages, it tells me that I've invited you to like start using that. Why don't you use that app?
I refuse to keep installing more and more Facebook apps. I have Facebook. I use Facebook.
Yeah.
I don't want apps for every little bit. Oh, do you want to post a picture instead of a photo? Like, what? No.
What does that even mean?
It doesn't. It means nothing. Messaging should be just the same part of my process as opening like a post or whatever, you know.
But I like the messaging app because it's basically like a texting app, you know.
Yeah, I just don't like that I have to install a separate app. It's just, you know.
Yeah. It's convenient for me, but I could see why you would be a holdout from the
I mean, I use Paper, their other app,
right.
and I can send messages just fine from there.
From Paper?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's,
oh, you're not even joking, right?
No, I'm
you're
not joking. I'm talking about
app.
The Facebook
I thought you were talking about I use an app called quote unquote Paper where I take a pen out.
No. I use Paper. It's got messaging.
Yeah. You tried to get me to use that and I don't like it.
And that's okay if you don't like it, but my point is it does the messaging.
It's I know it's okay I don't like it because you're dumb for liking it. Tougher bluff, Berto. Women are better than men regarding economic negotiations, such as negotiating for a salary increase or a financial negotiation for a client. So again, tougher bluff. Women are better than men regarding economic negotiations. Tougher bluff.
Economic negotiations, I will say.
Like for a salary increase?
Ooh. Well, studies.
For negotiating for a client, like,
right.
like you're buying a house or something?
So I've seen studies that say that women are less likely to ask for a salary increase, but that's different than negotiating the salary increase. So I'm actually going to say tough because My theory here is that women will be more likely to negotiate based on the desired outcome rather than on the emotion of the economic transaction.
Well, it's tough. Your speculation might be true. According to a meta-analysis of 51 studies from several countries, it's true that women are better than men when negotiating economically, meaning that they get more money from the negotiations. Which is interesting and counter to stereotype, right?
Yep.
You know, what other speculation could we make as to why that would be true?
Because if they're mostly negotiating with men, the men might feel intimidated. The other one could be that they have something to prove. They feel they have something to prove because they traditionally have not been in positions where they would be making those negotiations. But I don't know. My bet's still on – because like – here's the thing. For most of our history and then most of our lives, like men handle the money. So like maybe I'm biased in this because I have such an emotional attachment around money, you know, but I feel like men are all like, we need to go make more money. We need to go do this. And I feel like maybe that's not quite as strong for women. And so maybe they have my theory again is that they have less emotional attachment to the money itself, and hence they can make a little bit more unbiased decision, and you know, and just like, hey, what is the outcome I want? I want to try to do this, okay. Whereas men might be more like preoccupied about the money itself. I don't know. That's my
interesting.
That's my wacky hypothesis.
That's your wacky hypothesis. All right, tougher bluff. Most people, including health professionals, can visually identify whether a man is at healthy weight, overweight, or obese. Most people, including health professionals, can visually identify whether a man is at a healthy weight, overweight, or obese. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I'm going to go bluff.
How come?
Different people carry it very differently.
Yeah.
And you might, someone might have a thin looking face, but, and they wear, you know, kind of baggy clothing, but you can't quite tell. But it turns out they have a lot of midriff fat, subcutaneous, whatever.
But healthcare professionals.
It doesn't matter. They're not trained to visually recognize out of, you know, they're trained to recognize symptoms based on blood pressure and blood analysis and urine samples and stuff. Not like, I don't know that you go through like the six semesters in college of, okay, now look at this picture. Is this man overweight? Anyways, I'm going bluff.
Bluff. They can't. It's true. You're right. The researchers found that most of the healthcare professionals underestimated the men's weight, often believing that overweight men were a healthy weight. Which I
underweight or overweight?
Overweight. Believing that overweight men were at a healthy weight. Yeah. So basically, most people, including healthcare professionals, think that overweight people are healthy weight and obese people are just overweight. And I think that's probably because the norm of the human body in America has been becoming bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to take a guess and say that if we conducted this study 40 years ago, people would have been more accurate with their depiction. I mean, I've seen people, and, you know, I don't pass judgment on, I'm not going to pass judgment on whether or not people should be obese or should be thin. You know, people should be able to make their own choices about their own bodies, and that's great. But I find that a lot of people in today's world, they will, you know, like if you say, if you know, there's two people talking, I've seen this scenario, and it looks like person A is overweight, that mm-hmm. they would probably be healthy if they lost some fat cells, you know, 10, 20 pounds. And person A that is overweight talks to person B and says, I need to lose weight. I need to lose about 10, 20 pounds. Almost invariably, the second person will convincingly say, that's ridiculous. You don't need to lose weight. You're perfect. And when I look at the person, because I'm older, or I don't know, or something, or I've been to Japan and I see like how thin normal can be compared to Americans, my reaction is, don't say that to that person. I mean, we don't want to shame people for being overweight, but if someone is just saying in a differentiated manner that they want to lose 5 or 10 pounds, I don't think you should argue with them and tell them that they're being ridiculous, particularly if they are overweight and particularly if that is going to harm their health, you know?
It's so different too culturally, I think, and not only culturally from region to region, but almost even family to family, maybe.
Right.
Like in my case, when I go to visit in Colombia, oh my God, it's brutal. It's like everyone, my grandmas, my uncles, my aunts, my friends, they're like, oh my gosh, you are so fat. You got to lose weight now. I can't believe you got so fat. And by the way, many of my friends are way bigger than me.
Oh,
but
really?
But it doesn't matter. They're so vocal about it. Partially because I used to be super, super skinny. And so I think that they're like, that doesn't fit their vision of. But like no one holds back. It's like, oh my God. It's like really like, I can't believe how fat you got.
Right.
Like, oh, you know, it's like, oh God, calm down. Like,
yeah. Asians are similar. Yeah. And family's going to be really ridiculing. Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that in the United States, the culture is progressing in a direction. And I think that originally Americans were like that. They would mm-hmm. shame. And then eventually we figured out that that was bad for people, that shaming people about their bodies might drive them to have an eating disorder or, you know, have them to want to commit suicide because they feel mm-hmm. terrible about themselves. So as a culture, we've said, don't ever, ever tell someone to lose weight. And if they say they want to lose weight, then try to make themselves feel better because we don't want people to have low self-esteem. But I think the pendulum has swung way too far where if you just said to the average person, you know, I want to lose weight, most people will react negatively to that. And the other thing is that people tend to, in my world, because I work with a lot of therapists and a lot of therapists work with eating disorder people, is if you talk at all about wanting to lose weight, it's almost like a taboo topic.
Body dysmorphia.
Right. It's like, it's like you're instantly accused that you're pathological.
Yeah.
And there are absolutely pathological examples of people that will say things like, I need to lose weight.
Yep.
You know, anorexia, you know, people will be at a healthy weight and this, and they think they need to lose 30 pounds and then they endeavor to lose those pounds. That's not healthy. But if you're 30 pounds overweight, like the average American is, and you say you want to lose weight, that is not a bad idea. Yeah. And the other thing is, some people motivate themselves through, you know, a tiny bit of self-shaming. Like, my place is filthy. I gotta clean my place up. Now, if they're saying my place is filthy with the result of tearing their ego to pieces, then yeah, that's a bad thing. But if they're just kind of using a little shame, message to get something, to emphasize something to themselves, then that's a little different. Now, I'll also say that there are probably better ways of talking to ourselves. Like, I would like to lose weight, but I don't really need to. I'm still a good person, you know, or I would like to lose fat cells because I want to be healthier, but and I'm going to give it a shot and we'll see if it works, rather than saying I'm a fat piece of ass.
Right.
So and plus, when you say those kinds of phrases, even if you don't mean them, other people might hear you and might think that you believe that it's bad to be of a certain weight or something.
I actually do know. I know someone who is actually too far on the side of when their stuff is, when their place is messy. And actually, I'm saying when their place is messy, but it's not. It's when their place needs to be straightened up a little bit. They will say, you know, I can't go out Friday. Why? Don't you see? Like, this place is a complete disaster. And then you're like, what are you talking about? And then you look around and it's like, I could straighten this up in 5 minutes. Like, but in their head, it's like embarrassing and it's this complete, that's the extreme, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, listen, well, clean it, but it's not a disaster.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, and why are you saying that about your...
Yeah. I hadn't thought about this topic before spewing it out of my mouth, so I realize it's coming out in this weird way. We absolutely need to stop self-shaming and shaming other people, absolutely, about their weight and about the cleanliness of their home or how organized they are or how much exercise they do. We need to stop the shaming because that doesn't help anybody. And at the same time...
You're saying point and laugh then?
Right. And at the same time, we need to also allow people to motivate themselves in whatever way that works. And not shame them for using a phraseology that is slightly self-shaming, even though they don't really feel ashamed of themselves. Do you know what I mean?
Yep. No, I hear that. That's because I've done it too to myself with many different things throughout my life. And I'd say that on average, I'm always pretty positive to myself. But I can look back and think, wow, actually, that was pretty unfair to my, like in certain cases. Like I remember one time I was in high school and I didn't do so well in a race. It was a cross country race, you know. And I remember like my inner talk was like, well, you deserve this because you didn't do this and because you didn't do that and you didn't train hard enough and you ate too much last night. And it was just like a laundry list of like why I suck. And it stuck with me because I'm like, probably didn't help me for the next race, actually, you know. So, but it is a balance because there should be a healthy way to self-analyze and be like,
right,
you know what? What could I have done differently? You know, right. And so anyways. Yeah.
You know what? I want to lose 20 pounds.
Yeah.
And there should be a way of being able to say that without having everyone jump down your throat. You know what I mean?
Stop killing yourself!
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's weird. It's like the scenario that I think of, I don't think I've ever seen. You know, person A says, I think I want to lose 20 pounds. I want to do that. And person B is like, well, good for you. Well, maybe I have seen that happen. It's just like...
It sounds rare, though. It actually sounds odd.
Right.
As you're saying, I'm like, you don't hear that much.
No. Yeah, imagine you're at work and you said to a few of your...
I got to lose 20 pounds.
I want to lose 20 pounds. How many of them would be like, oh,
great,
good for you?
Great. What's your plan? That's good. That's a good question because either there's silence or like, huh. I mean, and most of them might be like, yeah, me too. Maybe that. You know, like, yeah, me too. Everyone does. Everyone needs to. Or not even that. It's more like...
To me, and I haven't done a study, half of the time you'll hear someone say, no, you don't.
Yeah, that'll
What's
definitely...
wrong wrong with you? Yeah. You know, and you'll get this pushback of like,
don't worry about it. Life's too short to worry about stuff like that.
Right.
Ironically.
Right. Yeah. I mean, part of it, I think, is that people have, we're just such a screwed up culture when it comes to weight and food and exercise. And we just have this really immature way of looking at that kind of stuff.
You know, and part of it is the food thing is so powerful because we think it's our fault, right? It's like you were saying, like, oh, I'm such a fat piece of ass, right? It's like my fault. It's like, but the thing we don't realize or fully understand is how beholden we are to patterns that we didn't really decide on. We're just right. Like, I'm hungry. That food is all freely available in grand supply at cheap enough that I can afford to go to a buffet and eat for 2 hours.
Right. And how many messages are in our culture that really don't help us? Like, you should always eat breakfast. And it's, that's not even necessarily true when you look at the data.
I just read something. I don't know. Did you see this thing about
to give an example, there was a time where I would eat breakfast every day because I thought that would actually help me lose weight, but it probably helped me to gain weight.
Yes. Yes. That's probably right. I just read an article about how fasting at intervals or fasting in general actually has been demonstrated in rats anyways, in mice or whatever, that it leads to healthier cells and healthier and lower weight and all those kind of things. And the hypotheses and theories are that like the fasting cycles put small stresses on the cells and it encourages them to actually have better protection and use the energy more efficiently and all these kind of things.
And it kind of makes sense given that our ancestors probably didn't have a constant supply of Big Macs.
Right.
And that they would fast probably frequently.
Right.
You know?
But yet we eat on schedule whether we're hungry or not.
Right.
And even more than that.
Right. Yeah. At some point, I think I want to do a whole episode on weight loss, actually, because I think a lot of people are, I know a lot of people are thinking about it themselves, and I feel like there's a lot of misinformation out there, you know?
Yeah. Anyway. We should do it.
Yeah. All right, tougher bluff. Sadness lasts 240 times longer than shame. Than shame, surprise, fear, disgust, boredom, irritation, being touched, or feeling relief.
Sadness?
Being touched, like emotionally touched. Oh. Sadness lasts 240 times longer than a lot of other emotions. That's 24,000% longer.
Holy crap.
Tougher bluff.
Man, I'm sad about this, but I'm going to guess tough.
Really? Does sadness last a lot longer for you than other emotions?
Yes.
Would you care to elaborate?
Well, it sticks with you over the years. Like, here's the thing. In a previous episode, we were saying how, or we were theorizing about whether or not you only remember the bad things. And I was pretty vocal to say that I don't think you only remember the bad things. You might remember the salient things. But here's one thing I do agree with. I feel sadness from events a lot longer because it can reoccur a lot easier than I have to like really remember a happy event to then kind of feel that happiness. But that's my anecdotal evidence. So I'm saying sad events seem to pop up and bubble up easier and for years and years.
It's tough. Researchers asked 233 participants to recollect recent emotional episodes and report how long they lasted. Out of 27 emotions reported, the researchers found that sadness lasted the longest, and that was 240 times longer than shame, surprise, fear, disgust, boredom, irritation, etc. Which kind of makes sense, because fear, if you're afraid of something, it's usually acute. It's very quick. Whereas sadness, if you're sad about your pet dying, you'll probably say, I was sad about that for 5 weeks. You wouldn't say, I was sad about that for 5 seconds.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, and you know, you think about like breakups, right? And I remember I broke up with this girlfriend in high school, and it was like a decade later, I was still like, not constantly sad or anything, but still like, what could have been, you know, like that. I felt that pang of sadness.
Really? 10 years later?
Yeah. And of course, it was always... it was like less and less and less. But certainly a year afterwards, I was still feeling it.
Oh, yeah.
I was still like, you know.
Yeah, I had a client that was very upset that she was still dreaming about her ex-husband.
Wow.
And she was saying, there's something wrong with me. It's been like 6 months or 12 months or something, maybe less than that. And I'm still dreaming about my ex-husband. When is it going to stop? And I said, it's probably not going to ever stop. And she was like, what? Because in my experience with clients, that that, I mean, maybe the dreaming will subside a little bit, but the mourning and the pain will probably last their entire life. And it's a total misconception. And you exemplified this, is your romantic relationship ending 10 years later. You still had feelings about
it. And it was a short, the relationship itself was really short.
How short? Did she know your name?
Yeah, she did. But I mean, I was, the thing that made it so emotionally charged for me is because I was into that girl for a couple of years before we went out. And then we went out for, but it was only like a couple months. Mm. It was like 2 months. Mm.
Must have been great 2 months.
But it's a high school 2 months. It's not even like we were living together, right? It's you see her at recess.
But that's another misconception that I like to dispel sometimes. It's like, it's just high school.
High school.
Yeah. In some ways, romantic relationships, if intense enough in high school, can be the most intense relationship someone will ever have.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons. One, it's your first, so you feel like, imagine having chocolate for the first time. Right. Imagine having something sweet for the first time.
Right.
You're going to remember that experience because, and when you're having it, you're going to be just overjoyed.
What is this? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And you're going to be very fascinated with it. You fall in love for the 20th time, probably not as interesting.
Right.
Right. So there's that. The other thing is that teenagers are just as capable as adults at having meaningful feelings. And we downplay, it's just high school, no big deal. It is a big deal. It's huge. The other thing is at the time, hormonally and brain-wise and everything, things tend to be more intense. Feel it more intensely. Mm-hmm. When we feel feelings at that age in general, they're felt at a much more intense degree. Mm-hmm. When you get older and you feel the same feeling and it's the same experience, the feeling is much less intense. So I say, makes total sense that you would think about it for a long time after high school. Don't downplay. Don't be ageist against your high school self. Do you have one?
Yeah. Totally off topic. Movies. This is based on movies. The history of cinematography. The first film studios were built in 1920.
I'm gonna say bluff. It was earlier than that. The first film studios, I think France might have had one. Obviously, in the States, there were ones, but and I'm pretty sure there were films earlier than the 1920s. So I'll say
certainly
bluff.
Films. Yeah, it is bluff. It is 1897 first film studios. Wow. Isn't that crazy? It's not just like they made some films. There was a studio,
right?
And in fact, it says the first rotating camera for taking panning shots was also built in that year. So I always think of movies as, and I know that there were little movielets before that, but I always think of it like, yeah, the 1920s, right? But it's incredible that a whole 30 years earlier there was activity, around movies.
Well, I don't remember where I saw it, but like a documentary or something, or maybe it was actually a movie recreation, anyway, of this wacky movie studio in, maybe it was the 20s, but they were doing, it's the movie where the rocket goes into the moon.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's a famous one.
Right. And so that whoever made that film did a lot of really interesting things. Mm. I have a tougher bluff.
Yeah.
So during a recent Oscar party at my place, I won the contest. I won the contest by guessing most of the Oscar winners correctly. Tougher bluff.
I'm gonna go bluff because, like, if you were hosting the party, you probably excused yourself from participating first of all because you wouldn't have been rude enough to like win your own prize. I mean, that's ridiculous. Plus, you can't be that lucky. No one can be that lucky.
It's tough.
What?
You know, people said, "Hey, Kirk, it's your party. You're hosting the party. You put up the prizes. How can you win your own game? It's not my game because it's not like I had any information prior to the Oscars that you guys didn't have. Two, if I don't play the game, I'm pandering and I'm basically calling you people idiots that I automatically need to recuse myself because I'm so brilliant that I should just, let you guys win." And so, of course, I'm going to participate. And I designed the game, so I get to play the game.
Yeah, but you just
and if I win the game, I get to take the prize away, even though I put up the prizes.
Okay, well, tougher bluff. halfway through that game, I was ahead, damn it.
You were.
Okay, listen. The first movie about space travel came out in 1902.
First movie about space travel, 1902. That sounds about right. I'll say Tough.
What? How could you say Tough? That's crazy.
Well, I think they, for whatever reason, early films were somewhat interested in space travel, you know, like not like the way we would see it
yes,
today, but
it's Tough.
Yeah.
It's the trip to the moon that you were talking about.
Was that 1902?
That's 1902, A Trip to the Moon by Georges Méliès.
Yeah.
Yeah, 1902.
I think there's a movie about that where they, you know, they just recreated all that.
And
it's interesting because when you watch those films, you know, it's so two-dimensional. But
yeah.
But when they recreate how they made it, it's fascinating because it was all live.
Right. They didn't have special effects.
Right. I mean, they had a couple special effects that they used.
Meaning no computers.
Right. But they had to, so, you know, and that it was this fantastical scene where they take a rocket to Venus or the moon, and then the guy gets out of the rocket and there's all these fish that are flying around and like moon people, moon mermaids. And so it was just really interesting to see how it's basically like a stage play that they film and use special effects to make cool. Anyway, tougher love. People in less industrial societies rate highly masculine men and highly feminine women as more attractive. So people in less industrial societies, less industrial, like the States is a higher industrialized society, but people in less industrialized societies rate highly masculine men and highly feminine women as more attractive, tougher bluff, than people in industrialized countries. Does that make sense?
I'm going to say tough because it because you have less blending of cultures, less blending of sexes in the workforce, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to go bluff.
Right. That would be the wisdom, right? That's the intuition. That's what I thought. But it's bluff. It's the opposite.
So I said tough.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
People in industrialized and urbanized cultures rate masculine men and feminine women as more attractive. A team of psychologists, anthropologists, and biologists surveyed almost 1,000 participants from 12 populations around the world, from the primitive to the highly developed sorts of cultures, showing them sets of three opposite sex composite and digitally manipulated photos. For each set of photographs representing five different ethnic groups, researchers asked participants which face was most attractive and which appeared most aggressive.
Wow.
They found that only in the most industrialized and urbanized environments did people hold the opinion that highly feminine women and highly masculine men are attractive. Those from more,
wow,
what they call more primitive populations or less industrialized, often favored neutral faces and sometimes the least sex and sometimes the least sex typical ones. So in some of the less industrialized societies, they preferred more neutral faces. You know, they preferred men that looked less masculine and women that looked less feminine.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, what does that say about...
Because the idea that I think you're going for is that less industrialized societies are more natural humans, right? They're more they exhibit more natural human
yes.
behaviors, which is a, you know, a fine hypothesis whether or not it's true or not. But it might be. And what are we doing in our culture that creates more of it? Well, in my opinion, it's imagery. When you live in a real, you know, when you live in the real world, when you're in a less industrialized, less, you know, you're a tribe in the middle of Africa or Papua New Guinea or something, you don't have as much media access. So you're looking at real bodies, real people, real faces,
right.
Less makeup, less Botox. And whereas when you're in our society, the images that we see are completely doctored to accentuate things, to exaggerate things.
I'll tell you the one that threw me, though, because that makes so much sense, especially for the feminization one or the feminized one. The one that threw me was I was thinking more of like rugged
right.
guys. Because
But we do that in our culture, too. We ruggedize guys. We make men more rugged.
More rugged.
You know, and but it is sort of weird because you would think that, like in the States, for instance, we would privilege more feminine looking men.
Yeah, you would think because the models and things, pretty boys, blah, blah,
right.
blah.
Right. You know, like Justin Bieber and this sort of thing.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, it's not true, which I find also, I always love research like this that counters our common idea of how things work.
I just sat on my thumb. It's like, ah.
So I don't know if you remember this, but a month or two ago, you and I made a joke, or you made a joke, I think, what? You said,
you were
saying what?
Yeah, yeah.
And then I laughed my A off.
Yeah.
And then I said, if anyone got that joke, write
us. Did someone get it?
And someone got it.
No way.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Someone emailed me
I didn't know that they would get it.
Neither did I.
I mean, it's kind of obscure. Right?
Kind of obscure. Plus, not really explicit.
And not recent.
Right. Yeah. What was that, like 7 years ago? 8 years ago?
Yeah, it was like 2008.
Yeah, at least.
Or seven, no, 2007.
Yeah, seven or six.
Yeah, it was, because I remember you guys joking in my basement and stuff. Yeah,
me too. Okay, tougher bluff, Berto. Hearing positive gossip about other people motivates people to work harder on self-improvement. So hearing positive gossip, like, did you hear about Joni? She's so great. So hearing positive gossip about other people motivates people to work harder on self-improvement. Tougher bluff.
Yeah, that's probably tough because, like, you get jealous and you're like, oh, what? They had success. I need success. I'm going to learn a new language.
Great success. It's tough. The researchers found that positive gossip had self-improvement value, motivating people to work harder on their own lives. All right, here's another one. Hearing negative gossip about other people degrades self-esteem in people. So if we start talking S about Joey, then we will actually have lower self-esteem. Tougher bluff.
That's an interesting one.
Sorry.
If
we hear negative gossip happening.
Yeah, did you hear Joey cheating?
And we hear that, then our self-esteem will go down. Tougher bluff.
No, it sucks, but I'm going to go the schadenfreude route and say that it's a bluff. We actually feel like, oh, good, that's not me. So we actually feel like we are better in that moment.
It's bluff. You're right. Negative gossip elicits pride, providing people with social comparison information that made them feel better about themselves.
It's funny.
It's a proven cognitive social psychology phenomena that, and it shows why we talk S about people.
Yeah.
When we talk S about people, we feel better about ourselves.
Did you hear about, like, they were trying to talk about this topic in this other psychology podcast, and they sucked. Like, they couldn't cover the topic at all. Wow. Like, we're so much better than them.
Yeah. Well, of course.
All right, here's a tougher bluff. By the 1920s, the United States was producing an average of 100 feature films annually. 100 feature films by 1920s.
I am going to say bluff that it was 1,000.
Wow. It is a bluff, and you're actually close. It was 800. And actually, an average of 800. So sometimes it could have been 1,000. That was 82% of the global total. I can't believe in 1920s, 800 feature films.
Right. There's a whole section of American or world film that has been completely forgotten.
No
about.
One's ever seen.
Right.
I mean, how many movies?
Because it's so bad is
the
thing.
Well, that's fair.
It's so bad.
How many movies from the 1920s have you seen?
Yeah. Well, when was Citizen Kane? Was that in the 20s?
30s, right?
I don't know.
40s?
30s. The KKK movie, was that?
The Birth of a Nation.
Yeah, was that 20s?
Yeah, that was earlier, I think. 17 or something.
Yeah, and then the one with the rocket and the moon.
But the point is, like, out of
Metropolis,
you've seen like 0.01%.
Right. It's true. Well, we should have a watching party.
Oh,
and then
God.
We could play a game about who won the Oscars, and I'll win that one too.
A guessing game. You're too lucky.
Lucky? It was
lucky.
Total. I saw almost every movie that the Oscars.
But no, you did. All the independents and the foreign movies and you did it.
I did get lucky on some of those.
Yeah. The movie The Jazz Singer, The Jazz Singer, which was mostly silent, was the first movie to have synchronized dialogue and audio.
Right. I think that is tough. I think The Jazz Singer is famous for having audio. Although, no, wait, how did you say that?
Was the first movie to have synchronized dialogue. And it's got singing, too. So, in general, synchronized audio. Yeah.
I think it's famous for that. I'm pretty sure it's famous for that, so it seems like it'd be tough. But I'm going to say bluff because usually when we identify something as the first, there was someone else that did it before them, but they just weren't as famous. So I'll say
this is why you won the damn Oscar thing, because that's right. That's tough. It's good intuition. It was generally regarded as the first, but it turns out, and they didn't have the internet back then, so... You know,
how did they know anything?
Really? How did
they? I mean, how did they Google something without the internet?
It was like, hey, I just invented electricity. It's like, well, how do you know? Like, we can't, since electricity doesn't exist here, we couldn't have sent a telegram or a message or something. Like, so I don't know how you even know.
Right. There's no Wikipedia.
Hey, my traveling salesman hasn't come by with the latest encyclopedia, you know? All right. So, but the thing is, they probably did have access to Yahoo.
Right.
All right. Now,
I think it was AOL back then, actually.
Oh, was it AOL?
Or no, it was Alta Vista.
Oh, American, because of American on, yeah, that makes sense.
It was Alta Vista, if you...
Anyways, the point was that it was, wait, I lost the thing. Yeah, it was generally regarded that the jazz singer was the first, but it turns out that it was first accomplished by Charles Taze Russell in 1914, like a decade earlier, with a film called The Photodrama of Creation. Incredible.
Very meta title there.
Yeah.
All right, Trevor Bluff. A family-focused, culturally informed, intense treatment for schizophrenia reduces patient symptoms and improves patient and caregiver emotional well-being. So this is this is therapy that is family-focused and culturally informed, and it's intense. And it helped people with schizophrenia, helped them to reduce their symptoms because, well, anyway, Tougher Bluff.
Family focused. I'm going to go bluff because I feel like schizophrenia, you would really not have an impact on it just by, I don't know, but I'm going to say bluff.
Right. That would be the intuition would... Right. But it's tough. The patients who participated in the program reported significant reductions in their hallucinations, delusions, and other psychiatric symptoms, and their caregivers reported significantly lower levels of guilt, shame, and burden of care. And this is something that is not understood or well talked about in our culture, which is that people benefit a lot from certain kinds of family therapy because we do not exist we're not individuals that exist individually. We are organisms that exist within human systems, in family systems, in cultural systems, in ecological systems. And so in order to treat the patient, it is sometimes best to treat the system, to treat the family, to treat the community. And without treating the system, you do not get at an opportunity to help them.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, because if I would have just... If I hadn't seen this study and someone said, do you think family therapy would help schizophrenic people? I would say, well, it probably doesn't reduce their symptoms, but it might help them cope better. You know, they might feel better, they might feel more supported, but their delusions aren't going to go down because that's a brain disorder.
Right.
But it actually reduces their hallucinations, delusions, and other symptoms.
That's incredible.
When they get family therapy. So
I mean, it's after knowing the fact, I guess I can see like, oh, well, hey, chemicals in the brain having interactions with each other, some positive ones might help with the negative ones. I could see that. But intuitively, you just I guess it shows how little we bet on like tried and true mechanisms for all the time before there was medicine, you know, which is just the only thing we could have done, which is companionship and society. And I said tried and true, not like we could actually cure polio and things, but you know what I mean. Okay, I have a gripes of wrath.
Your face is so intense, it's scaring me.
Yes. So, I am at the office, you know, as you know, I work with motivation and power, right? And because of this, there's lots of different personalities in the office. And I got to say, I just raised, by the way, it's a new job because I didn't work in motivation and power before. And so it's a new job. And so I've been meeting lots of new people and stuff. And up until now, everyone I had met was great. And then the other shoe dropped. One individual. Now, I'm not going to go too hard on the sense like it's only one instance, so I'm not going to conclude a pattern yet. Except, well, it's actually one instance to me, but I had noticed one similar instance to someone else. So I'm like,
What'd they do?
Here's the deal. An email goes out about an idea, and everyone's kind of like pitching in ideas and stuff. And then this person sends out their contribution, and they say, I think we should expand the idea like this. And they kind of describe it. So I think I want to support, I want to do the yes and, right? So I go and I draw up a little diagram and I write back. I'm like, oh, that's a great point. Maybe we could actually do this. And then I put my diagram up. Okay. So let me ask you a question. Let's say that you're in a situation like this. And let's say my diagram doesn't make any sense. Let's just assume that it doesn't make any sense. But you're in this office setting and stuff like that. And I was sounding like I wanted to support your idea. Right, but my diagram makes no sense. What might you write back?
If I'm understanding the social context well enough, I would just ignore. Personally, this is how I deal with things sometimes. I'd just be like, oh, okay. I'd try to pull what you were saying and sort of build on it. But if I wanted to be more direct, I would say something like, well, thanks for the support. I really dig that. But I really don't understand your graph. So could you explain it to me?
Right. And that's natural, right? Now, obviously, I'm biased about my diagram. But I'm going to say it's by no means the most confusing diagram that I've ever made or that I've seen, right? It's actually a pretty straightforward diagram. But I'll allow that maybe some people might find it confusing, right? But the reply was like completely not acknowledging that I was actually trying to support the idea. It was just all about how confusing the diagram was and how we can't use that diagram. And like, to me, that was the silliest thing to harp on, because it's like, so throw the diagram away. Fine. But we've now stopped the discussion on the ideas because now we're focused on the diagram.
And everyone's now gun shy, if that's the right term.
Yes, to contribute.
To contribute anything because they're worried they're going to get shot down.
Yes. So my gripe of wrath is no but individuals. At the workplace. No, but.
He's at a podcast right now doing a gripe of wrath saying, if you're going to make a diagram, make it understandable.
Yeah.
All right, tougher bluff. Seeing pictures of others being loved and cared for reduces the brain's response to threat. So tougher bluff, seeing pictures of other people being loved and cared for reduces the brain's response to threat. Tougher bluff.
Oh, I could see that. I'll go tough because you project and you kind of picture yourself, you empathize with that situation, and then you might feel some protection as a result of seeing the protection. So going tough.
Good, tough. Yes, that's a speculation. They used fMRI to study brain activity in 42 healthy adults who had viewed pictures of people receiving emotional support and affection. The researchers found that after subjects looked at the photos, their brain's threat monitor, the amygdala, surprisingly did not respond to a second set of images showing threatening facial expressions or words. So not only should we expose people to other people being loved and cared for, but we should allow ourselves and cultivate that in the world in terms of people being loved and cared for. It makes total sense. It's like when a plane is going down, what do people do? They look to the person next to them and they hold their hand or they hug that person or they do something like that. And when we are together, it very much reduces our fear response because we're very dependent animals.
We're in the trench together.
Yeah. And when you're in the trench together, it makes it all better. When you're alone, like a lot of people, I just don't want to die alone.
Right.
And, this study studies that phenomenon.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's just
another plug for everyone to have supportive relationships and to have nurturance in
right.
their life. And
right.
by the way, all of these tougher bluffs, as a lot of my tougher bluffs, derive from the APA monitor.
Okay. The script for E.T., did you ever see E.T., of course?
Yeah.
The script for E.T. was written in...
Actually, as a side note, I saw on Reddit the other day that Spielberg, in making a movie prior to E.T., had Close Encounters, or wait.
Uh-huh.
He needed evil aliens to... He needed concept art for evil aliens.
Uh-huh.
And one of the concept art drawings was of E.T.
Of E.T.?
But an angry E.T.
Oh, weird.
And so later, when he made E.T., to have a benevolent alien, he pulled from that concept art and made angry E.T. into benevolent E.T.
It's happy E.T.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Okay, you can totally see that because E.T. is a disgusting looking alien.
Yeah.
It's all wrinkly and...
Right.
You know what I mean?
But they made him cute.
But they made him cute, yeah.
They made him, act cute.
Right.
But the script for E.T. was written in 1967 by an Indian director named Satyajit Ray.
Wow. That's possible. E.T., written by... So someone living in India.
I don't know if he was from India. I don't know where he lived.
Indian
but it
guy.
Was Indian director Satyajit Ray wrote the script for E.T. in 1967.
I'll say tough. That sounds possible. A lot of scripts move around Hollywood for many years before actually being made into movies. So I could see that being possible.
It's almost tough. He actually wrote a script for The Alien, not Alien, the Alien movie, but it was called The Alien, which was going to be his first Hollywood movie, but production was canceled. Nevertheless, the script went on to influence later films such as E.T. So he didn't literally write the script for E.T., but his script influenced E.T.
Who wrote E.T.?
I can look it up.
All right. Contrary to common intuition, a person's credit score is a relatively weak predictor of health status. So contrary to common intuition, a person's credit score is a relatively weak predictor of health status. Tough or bluff?
Interesting. Credit score. Well, it depends because if you know your credit score and you know it's low, that might stress you out and that might worsen your health. If you don't know your credit score, but you are the kind of person that would have a low credit score, you might have that stress anyways because of the reasons why your credit score would be low. I'm going to go bluff. It is correlated. If you have a lower credit score, you probably have health concerns.
Right. It's bluff. It's a strong predictor.
Ooh, strong predictor.
Findings point to a strong relationship between low credit scores and poor cardiovascular health.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
So why bother going to the doctor? Just check your score.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Do you know what your credit score is?
I know what it was and what it's becoming. So I had a couple of unfortunate setbacks because of the financial... And
that
housing
affected
market.
Your credit score?
Yeah, because whenever you get a foreclosure.
Oh, you had a foreclosure?
I had a rental property that was no longer being able to be rented, and it had been kind of destroyed by one of the tenants and blah, blah, blah. And I tried to sell it.
Was it up north?
No, it was down south. And I was trying to sell it for a while, and it just never sold. And then I tried to do a short sale, which is a type of not quite a foreclosure, and it didn't go on short sale, and eventually the bank just foreclosed on it. Right. But I couldn't afford to keep it because I was paying the mortgage without any rent, and it was at a time where I already had other financial struggles. So I had to go through that foreclosure, and as a result, my credit took a big hit.
Yeah.
But luckily, I've since repaired a lot of it. I used to have a fantastically good credit.
So what numbers are we talking here?
Well, I was like 800.
Yeah.
And then it dropped to like 530 or something.
Oh.
And then it's...
530 is not bad, right?
Well, it's...
not good, but...
not good. You can't get a lot of stuff. It's back to 650 or something, and it's climbing back up. I got to tell you, the power and motivation business helps repair your credit.
Yeah, I remember talking with a lot of clients in 08, 09 about all this stuff and how stressful it was for them. It ruined marriages in my clients.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, it was terrible. Tougher bluff. You were once winning the Oscar poll, but then you lost it in a humiliating way.
Bluff. I was not humiliated. Okay. This one is a gimme. A total gimme. Jurassic Park was the highest grossing film of all time up until Avatar took it over.
I think that's bluff. I mean, I know Jurassic Park. What do you mean, like in the theaters only, or like all time?
It just says highest grossing film of all time.
I think that means ticket sales usually. I don't know. I think that's bluff. Let's see. What would I say would be the highest grossing movie
before Avatar?
Yeah, between Jurassic Park and Avatar. God, did The Matrix make more? I think one of the Pirates movies made a ton of money.
That's probably true. However, it was even simpler than that. You are right, it was bluff. Titanic.
That's right, Titanic. Right.
Yeah. Also by
right.
You know, James Cameron.
Right. But man, when I'm happy to be alive when CGI came into its own. I remember watching CGI in the 90s, and it was just terrible. You know, it was just real boxy, and they weren't even trying to make it realistic. You know,
although ironically, the Jurassic Park still stands up, which was weird because it was way before so many movies.
I'll never forget that scene when they go on that trek in that Jeep. Mm-hmm. They ride out into the park.
Yeah.
And that flock of
raptors or the
they're plant eating dinosaurs that come running by.
Yeah.
Oh, iguanodon. It was so convincing. I mean, I bet you if I watched it now, it wouldn't be as good as they could make it today, obviously. But it still holds up. It was, I mean, I was like, in my head, it just did not compute. I thought, how did they get, wait.
Yeah, right?
How did they get dinosaurs? Wait, that can't be, wait, what? How?
What is going on?
Yeah, I mean, the camera's moving. There's humans involved. The dinosaurs had the shading that looked real. It didn't look metallic or weird. It was, I just thought.
And the lighting was the biggest thing.
Right.
Because even like a decade later, and I would even say even today, there are still movies that come out that are very CG heavy where the lighting doesn't feel right.
Right.
Certainly early on, but even more recently, because it's got a little too much orange to it, or it feels wrong.
Right.
To me, it's always felt like a snow globe effect. Like that's not the real sunlight. You didn't get that with that movie. It was like, that's filmed.
Right.
Those are real dinosaurs. Right. Even if you know they can't be real, and you're like, that looks so real.
You know what drives me nuts about CGI?
What's your gripe?
Here's my gripe of wrath. Is that, and I'm pretty sure it's a phenomenon that it's called something in the CGI world, but what happens is you give a CGI programmer, artist, person the task of creating 3 seconds of film. So you need someone, you need the guy to walk into the room and stand there, okay? Now, if you're directing it in real life and you have, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal, and you say, walk into the room and stand there. Well, it takes so little time and little effort that Jake Gyllenhaal will just act natural. He'll walk into the room and stand there. When you give someone a task that probably takes a month, literally, to code 3 seconds of action, this individual will memorize every split second. And what happens is they end up stretching the 3 seconds into like 3 hours. And so what ends up happening is the person walks in the room and they quickly shift from side to side and their eyes move side to side because they have the capability to have lots of action because, you know, it's all computer programming. And so they don't want to show off what they can do with the character. They don't want to just have the character walk into the room and stand there stiff. They want to show that they can make it move, you know? It's like someone picks up a doll and they don't just, if it moves, what's the first thing to do? They just start moving the limbs.
Right.
and so it's like that. And it drives me crazy. Like it's particularly with the eyes. There's like lots of darting of eyes because they're trying to prove.
It's real.
Look what I can do with the eyes.
And the hair maybe flowing everywhere.
Right, because the opposite of being alive is being stiff and being completely unmoving. So they make this leap, like if I make it move a lot, then it must look more real. And every time I see it, it drives me nuts. Do you ever notice this?
I do, but what's funny is right now I'm watching your eyes move, and I'm realizing you don't look very real at all because your eyes are darting everywhere.
But just add this to the list of pet peeves of in film, like wet streets. I've talked about that before. What else? Another thing that bothers me is when they shoot footage and then the director, editor says, okay, instead of the guy looking at the flag and then looking down at the ground, I want him to be looking down at the ground and then looking up at the flag. Well, what's the solution? We'll just take that clip and reverse it in time.
Oh, right.
Except I can totally tell when someone blinks in reverse.
Oh, sure, yeah.
but they don't think we can tell. They think when you blink in reverse, you can tell. Or when a flag is flowing in the wind in reverse, I can tell.
Of course.
Or when water is flowing the wrong way up the hill, I can tell. And so I'm watching a movie, and just because they had this anal little detail that they wanted to do, it completely ruins it for me, because now I'm like, oh, now I'm watching a crappy edited movie. You know what I mean?
Man, that sounds gripey.
did you ever notice that?
When I notice it, it's probably because it's very bad. Because I usually, was I mentioning to you? No, I was mentioning it to someone else. I have recently, really started to pay more attention to the film, the camera work and the shot angles and things like that. For most of my movie watching career, it kind of went over my head. Like, not that I don't understand.
Did Birdman do it to you?
Actually, it's funny. It wasn't Birdman. It was
Barney.
Well, the most recent one that I noticed myself doing it is a movie called Blue Ruin.
Oh, I know those guys.
What?
That is one of the best movies.
Wait, how do you know them? Like, what?
They've been making movies for a long time.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so can we do a podcast about it?
Sure.
Because psychologically, it's so rich.
In fact, I won that DVD at a Christmas party.
What?
In December, and that's why I didn't even know.
Can we have someone as a guest from that movie?
They don't live. I think they're in the East
Coast.
Okay,
but we should do that movie is so rich with psychology.
Yeah.
We should do, okay, but anyways, my point is, that movie, maybe because it's such a straightforward and simple premise, even though it's complex and it's layers and stuff,
yeah.
It actually made me appreciate like how they're sitting there framing every shot and every angle. And it reminded me of a friend from many years ago who was obsessed about it, but this is like 20 years ago. And I couldn't care less when he would start talking about it. But he would talk about Pulp Fiction and about all these movies. And I'm like, boring.
Well, that's me. And I bore everyone around me. You know, I have this joke with some of my friends where if it's all one shot, you know, if they do a scene in a movie where it's all one shot, meaning they don't edit different camera angles, I always say all one shot. And then they always laugh at me because they don't care that it's all one shot.
Well, okay, so.
So during Birdman, that's all I was saying to people around me. All one shot. All one shot. All one shot.
How many shots were there? Do you know?
Well, there were times when it was pretty clear that they cut. But.
And then there's some less.
But my estimation based on, it's probably about a 2-hour movie.
Yeah.
I think it was like every 15 minutes-ish. There would be another shot. And in fact, back in the day, a film was only like 15 minutes long. Like in a film camera for movies, the longest shot you could have was something 15 like 15 minutes.
Wow.
But I don't know if the movie was shot digitally or not. So
interesting. All right. So back in the time where the highest paid actor in Hollywood was probably going to get $10 million, which is when Batman came out.
Which Batman?
The original. The OG.
The Keaton. One with Keaton. Okay.
Yeah. Speaking of Birdman. Jack Nicholson earned, after figuring out the percentage of the gross, so not just his salary, but his percentage take of the movie, he got $30 million. Tough or bluff?
So you're saying that Keaton got $10
million. No. Jack Nicholson, the Joker.
Yeah.
I don't know how much Keaton.
Oh, you don't know how
the tougher bluff is that back when, like, just to put it in reference, right? This is way before Jim Carrey got famous because he made $20 million in a movie. This is way before that. This is like they might have paid someone $10 million. Back then, Jack Nicholson earned $30 million from his portrayal of the Joker.
I'll say bluff. It's probably not that high. But I can absolutely imagine them having to pay him for that because they really wanted to make this movie legit and and Jack Nicholson at that time was at the top of his career.
Yeah.
I mean, he was seen as a god back then. And so he would absolutely demand a lot of money. And he was pretty much the star of that movie.
Yeah.
I mean, do you remember Batman? No, you remember Jack Nicholson.
Right.
So, I'll say bluff because, I mean, unless he got like a percentage of the gross.
No. That's what I'm saying. Like, it couldn't have been the salary. No one was getting those kind of salaries.
Oh.
I'm saying because of his percentage, which would have had to still be very high, because of his percentage, he got $30 million.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll say tough. yeah.
All right. It's bluff. It's $60
million. Whoa.
It's $60 million.
That's insane.
$60
million. I mean, for movies back then, yeah.
I mean, it's because of the percentage, but that's insane.
It must have been like, you know, he gets 3% of the proceeds.
Yeah.
And they thought, well, if this movie makes a ton of money, then we don't mind paying him $60 million, but if it doesn't do so well, then he doesn't get that much.
I mean, he might have been paid $10 million right out the bat, but like I cannot believe it. Like,
yeah, just from one
Batman,
movie.
Batman was huge.
And
it exceeded box office records, for sure. But we're talking about 1989.
Yeah.
89.
I haven't watched that movie since then. Have you seen that? I'm Batman.
It's been a long time, actually. I liked it. I
remember liking it. Prince had a whole thing, but I bet you anything, it's not very good.
It's got to be better than almost all the other ones, except for the most three recent, right? It's got to be better than 2, 3, 4.
Well, I remember they got really bad, like
because the one with
Jim Carrey,
George Clooney,
the one with George Clooney.
Arnold.
Yeah, and Arnold. I remember those having very interesting set designs and costumes, but the movies were just
terrible.
They were like cartoony, you know.
The second one was not that great, but the Penguin was interesting. You know? But it was still not a good movie, really.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if the first one wasn't very good either, you know? Because it's like, how could it have been that good?
But yeah, I don't know.
I'll have to watch it.
But Jack Nicholson set the bar, and it was only finally met by what's this guy that committed suicide? No.
Oh, Robin Williams?
No, the Joker from the new Batman series.
He didn't commit suicide.
Or overdose?
Yeah, he overdosed.
Oh, he overdosed, yeah.
I mean, I think people might think he's committed suicide, but
what's his name again?
Heath Ledger.
Heath Ledger, yes.
So then he made a bunch of money?
No, I'm saying as far as like setting the bar for
standard for the Joker.
For how good to be in a villain.
Yeah.
Like it was the Joker, you know?
Yeah.
And I
actually didn't think the Joker, I mean, I liked that character, but people look at that character like he's the best villain of all time. And I'm like, I just don't agree with that.
I don't know if it's the best villain, but it was. I don't think any villain had been quite as entertaining until you saw Jack Nicholson as the Joker.
But I think that was largely due to the directing and the writing.
Sure.
Because, like, in terms of Heath Ledger's, and I know all the nerds out there will hate me for saying this, but Heath Ledger's performance, you know what I mean? Like,
I thought it was brilliant, man.
See, that's that word, brilliant.
Brilliant.
And I'm like, yeah, it was good. I liked it. I would never hack on it. But in the grand body of film in America, in the world,
he had to somehow go up against what people remembered, which was Jack Nicholson killed it. You don't need another Joker. It's over.
And yet he did something new. Well, how could you not with that writing and that cinematography? I mean, it was a completely different tone and completely different story. And I wouldn't attribute that to Heath Ledger only. That's for sure.
No, that's fair. But
and really, I don't know. Like, there's just certain scenes where it's just, it works because of the whole package. Like when he's trying to blow up the hospital and the detonator isn't working, and in real life when they were filming the detonator didn't work.
Yeah.
And then and then Heath Ledger, the guy, is like, "Oh, this is a blown shot." And he kind of turns around and then it explodes, and then he kind of gets a real reaction like,
sure,
"Oh."
Sure.
And then he gets back
into
character. Yeah. I wouldn't say that was a brilliant performance by him. I would say, you know, there are a lot of elements going into that made that a compelling scene.
But I think, granted, and that's a great example of, like, it's not him in that case. It's just the moment. But there were so many scenes that he did put his all in that people felt like, wow, that's a character. And others could have done it. It's not the only one who could have done it, but not everyone. And certainly not everyone as well. He sold it so well. Like, and it was a character that could have gotten on your nerves so easily. It's a character that could have just fallen flat, or people could have just compared him to Nicholson and been like, "Nah, you're just doing Nicholson." Nope. It was completely different, completely unique. Yeah. And granted, direction, absolutely. Cinematography, absolutely. But also Heath Ledger.
Right. But like in the third Batman movie, most recently, the Tom Hardy character, Bane, you know.
This is the moment of right. your liberation, like, Batman.
Like, that's, it was terrible.
Yeah.
But that's not his fault.
That's fair. I like Tom Hardy.
I love Tom. He's yeah. he's one of the best actors of all time, in my opinion. Yeah. But that's
but that's fair because you can't. I don't think there's
the director,
any...
the producer, the sound guy. You know, the everyone screwed up on you know
but
making a character and Tom
I don't
Hardy.
Think anyone blamed Tom Hardy?
No, they didn't. Yeah. But no matter how good Tom Hardy was, there was nothing he could do to overcome that. When you get a makeup artist and you get you know a director and a good writer and someone who can frame shots and can set up a story. You know, like when he takes that pencil and like breaks some. That's not his idea.
But the flip side argument is when you get okay. So like, what's the Shakespeare movie? Much Ado About Nothing. You know, surrounded by talented Shakespearean actors, including Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah.
Right. And here comes Ted from Bill and Ted. You know, or Bill is it Bill or Ted?
Keanu Reeves.
Yeah. Which one is he? Is he Bill or Ted?
He's Ted.
He's Ted,
I
right?
Think. Yeah.
Hey, and he comes and he's like.
Well, he's...
How dost thou... I mean, it's...
He's a bad example.
But what I'm saying is like...
He's one of the worst deliverers of dialogue.
Right. But that's what I'm saying. Like, you can have...
Although, have you seen...
All the other elements can be there, and the actor can still ruin it.
Did you see his most recent movie?
No.
It's pretty good. John Wick.
Is that the one where he goes on revenge?
Yeah.
I fell asleep. I was watching it in the hotel, and I fell asleep, so...
Oh. I think you need to watch it on the big screen. I mean, you have to watch it with...
No, I didn't fall asleep because it was boring. Oh. It was just... I always watch too late when I'm traveling, and so by that point, I'm already sleepy.
Like the time you fell asleep during Grand Budapest Hotel?
Did I fall asleep during Grand Budapest Hotel?
You fell asleep for
oh my God.
Half the movie.
No.
Yeah.
Really?
That's what...
So I still have not seen Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yeah.
Holy crap.
You're a terrible person.
I'm a terrible person. I'm like, oh, wow. I'm almost as bad as this person I know who fell asleep during The Usual Suspects from, like you're saying, about half the movie, and woke up at the very end when they were revealing Kaiser Soze.
All right. Well, that does it for another meandering episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us out there. Please take care of yourself because you deserve it.
Bye-bye. Actually...